Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. Oh, but sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Oh, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die.
Hi everyone, this is Dr. Michael Walt, and welcome again to my show, Ask the Blood Detective. I am the original blood detective, having been given that nickname by a grateful patient in the past, and it's stuck with me as sort of a badge of honor. Whenever I'm faced with difficult cases or just helping the average person that I see, I'm mindful of the concept of being a blood detective, which would, you might imagine, be someone who simply does not give up until he finds answers. And I encourage each and every one of you listeners to today's show to consider yourself a blood detective by listening to these shows, which you might have realized if you've listened to at least one of them, know that it's essentially, each show is its own master's course on each topic. I spend quite a bit of time putting together an outline of the general discussion I'd like to have, making sure that it is as thorough as possible. It is very reasonable that you might want to listen to any given show more than once, particularly if the topic is important to you and you really want to know it very well. When I do the show, like this show today on Lyme disease, called Lyme Disease Lies, I'm always mindful of including in each show the common misconceptions, common ways of approaching and dealing with each of the topics. So what I'm trying to say here is that each show will include a lot of the misunderstandings that I've heard over the course of my 26 or so year career. So again, I hope that you find it as practical as I intend it to be. And if not, simply let me know by emailing me at info@blooddetective.com or info@integratednutritionny.com. For those of you who want to see me as a patient, you could call my office directly at 914-242-8844. I also post the shows on my blog at the website that I just gave. Once again, that's www.integratednutritionny.com under the blog section. And any questions or input that you have, I would love for you to continue to post them on the blog or email me directly, and I will use those comments for show topics and to post other practical articles that you want. So let's talk about Lyme disease. What I'll do is start with all of what is generally known about Lyme disease, and I fully admit that Lyme disease is also, like many other infections, is there are a lot of blanks in terms of what we do know. One of the ways that I attempt to close the gap between what we know about a given topic and what we need to do and what we need to accomplish for someone who is in who's suffering, or who is in pain, for example, or is in suffering in some other way from Lyme disease or whatever the condition is again through the blood detective philosophy, which involves a careful consultation. Then it involves very individualized and broad laboratory tests that look at a variety of different systems in the body. You might need to go to several different specialists to get a view of the body, the way the blood detective philosophy outlines the testing. Now, that's not to say that I don't refer some of my patients to other practitioners. If there is a practitioner out there that is particularly good at something, or if a patient needs a specialist given some finding that I've had, I make that recommendation for them to go seek out that healthcare provider. But I always maintain close communication with both the patient and the provider so we don't lose what's known as the continuity of care. It's so frustrating for me when I see that answers have been found by different practitioners if they only spoke to one another to put the puzzle pieces together. And I've talked in prior shows how the compartmentalization of medicine and thus the medical education has broken up the body in different segments, and that's caused, of course, different specialties out of that, and that the inherent issue with that approach is that, well, you've heard the saying before, you can get too close to the tree that you might not see the forest, meaning that until practitioners look at things holistically, they will tend to miss things. So I start out that way, and we break things down from there if necessary. So with Lyme disease, an infection that may involve multiple systems that creates significant loss of quality of life, I thought it would be my duty to have at least a single show early on that describes what is known about Lyme disease, what is not known about Lyme disease, what the traditional medical approach or approaches are for Lyme disease and other co-infections, and then to talk about natural approaches towards the end of the show. So let's start with the basics, and most of these questions have actually come from you, the listeners, through your emails about everything you needed to know about Lyme disease when I had announced the show topic last weekend. So I've got lots of emails, and this is what you want to know. First of all, you want to know how Lyme disease is really caused. So Lyme disease is caused by a bacterium, Borrelia burgdorferi, and that bacteria is transmitted to humans through the bite of what's known as the black-legged tick. And symptoms of Lyme disease could be fever or fatigue, headache. Oftentimes, but not always, not even most of the time, there may be a skin rash, which those of you familiar with Lyme disease know as erythema migrans. But newer information tells us that any rash at all that is 2 inches or greater does not at all have to look like a bullseye rash. The erythema migrans could be Lyme disease. And if a person has symptoms that are suspicious for Lyme disease and they have a rash, then doctors should be testing for Lyme disease. And some of you are saying, well, the tests aren't very accurate. We're going to get to that. But if Lyme disease is left untreated, the infection can spread to the joints, the heart, and the nervous system, just to name a few of the symptoms. Now, Lyme disease is diagnosed based on symptoms, also what are known as physical signs, like the rash if it's present, and a history of whether or not the individual was exposed to infected ticks. Laboratory testing is helpful sometimes. Not always, of course, no test is perfect. But if used correctly, the laboratory testing can certainly reveal the presence of Lyme disease. And for those of you who are not familiar, there are two basic tests for Lyme disease. There is the Western blot and the ELISA test. And generally, the ELISA test is the only one initially done by traditional docs, and they'll do that. And if that test is elevated, the labs are generally instructed through their protocols to do the Western blot test, which measures what are known as bands, infective bands. There are IgG bands, and there are IgM bands. And the IgG and IgM bands refer to the immune system's production of those bands, which are antibodies. And antibodies are anti the body. They are immune molecules that attack tissues, causing destructive changes and then all the accompanying symptoms of Lyme disease. At least in this case, Lyme disease. Antibodies are produced in lots of other diseases as well, particularly autoimmune diseases. The Center of Disease Control originally said that if a person is found upon laboratory testing to have 5 or more of the IgG bands, they are considered positive for Lyme disease and therefore would be treated with the prevailing therapy, which currently is still doxycycline antibiotic. But a person may have fewer than 5 bands, IgG bands, or none. The other criteria through the Center of Disease Control, the CDC, is that if an individual has 2 out of the 3 IgM bands positive, they also would be considered positive for Lyme disease and would be treated. Now, what I'm about to say is often true, but is not always true. An individual with only IgM bands probably has a more acute or new Lyme disease infection, because the immunoglobulin M, the IgM bands, are the first part of the what's called the humoral immune system that produces the IgM molecules, which are made from antibodies, with a new infection. And then after the infection has been in the body for a while, the IgM bands typically go away to normal ranges, and then we see all the IgG bands. However, many people have significant symptoms of Lyme disease with just IgG bands or IgM bands or both bands. But the CDC, as far as I understand, never intended for their basic criteria, meaning diagnosis of Lyme disease if a person has five or more IgM bands and or two of the three IgM bands, the CDC never suggested that if those bands do not exist, that a person could not have Lyme disease. That's very important for you to hear, because that's one of the reasons why testing may just not reveal that a person has Lyme disease. Now, on the other hand, an individual, I have a lot of these patients, they believe they have Lyme disease, and they might, and they are treated with antibiotics, either doxycycline or something else, particularly if doxycycline had failed a few times previously to eradicate all their symptoms. And because these individuals feel better, or mostly better, after taking an antibiotic, they sometimes will erroneously conclude that, well, they must have had Lyme disease because they thought they did, and or they had in the past, or at least it was diagnosed in the past, and they feel better after repeated courses of antibiotics. Now, antibiotics are also generally considered anti-inflammatories, which simply means, as you might have guessed, that any health problem that may look like Lyme disease that has an inflammatory component might respond, and the person would feel better by taking antibiotics. That's really no different than most painful conditions being helped in terms of the pain expression with steroids like prednisone, but that does absolutely nothing for the underlying health problem. So I find it disturbing that there are so many individuals out there taking repeated courses of antibiotics, even by the so-called Lyme-literate physicians, when not enough due diligence is done looking for other causes of symptoms. I'm not at all saying that some of these individuals do not actually have Lyme disease that continue to go on repeated antibiotics, but some of them may be suffering from post-Lyme syndrome, and that's a term that applies to individuals who are known to have Lyme disease in the past, or at least we thought so, and they went through one or more antibiotic protocols, either oral and or intravenous antibiotics, but still have symptoms many months or even many years later. Now, Lyme disease tests, the IgM and the IgGs, they could be false positive from many other health problems. Other autoimmune diseases can and do often cause false positive Lyme disease tests. That's because, contrary to popular belief, these tests are not specific for Lyme disease. Now, there are some specialty labs out there, and there is a lab in New Jersey that claims to do specialized testing that can find your Lyme disease, and makes it their mission in life to claim that Lyme disease testing, and by the way, it's not Lyme's disease, it's Lyme disease, that Lyme disease testing that is done by the commercial labs do not check enough bands and are not specific enough and all that. My conversations with the specialty lab in New Jersey over the last few years has revealed to me that this might not be the truth, or at least not be the whole truth. The reason why, or one of the reasons why, many of the commercial labs have not started to do some of these other bands that this other specialty lab claims are the true bands that will reveal Lyme disease is because they're not reliable. So whether you believe this or not, because this is a bit contrary to what you might hear in natural medicine, I understand that, it is sometimes the truth. So all I'm saying from all of this part of the conversation today is that we should not necessarily all jump on the Lyme disease bandwagon. That's one of the lies in the show topic today, Lyme disease lies. Because I had a patient, for example, fairly recently, who had a cancerous condition and had all positive tests from that. And once the cancer was treated, the Lyme disease positive test went away. There are a number of autoimmune diseases that can fool the nervous system and fool the immune system, especially, into producing tests which look like Lyme disease tests. So any good healthcare provider with the proper training is able to perform what is called a differential diagnosis, which means not just jumping at what you know, things seem like Lyme disease or what we're calling Lyme disease, but do their due diligence in terms of testing and investigations and questionnaires and other techniques that increase the probability that Lyme disease is or is not the cause of so-called Lyme disease positive tests. So let me move into some of the symptoms and signs of untreated Lyme disease, the early signs that we might see in the first month or so, and late signs as well, and the traditional treatments. So untreated Lyme disease can produce a large number of very weird and strange symptoms in a variety of areas, and that depends on the stage of the infection as well. So fever, rash, facial paralysis, what's known as Bell's palsy, and arthritis are the typical ones. So if you suspect Lyme disease and you experience any of these symptoms, you must see someone right away. Please do not try to use natural methods to manage Lyme disease without first confirming if, in fact, you do have Lyme disease, and if so, a combination of traditional and alternative or nutritional treatments might be best. That's something you'd want to discuss with your practitioner. So the early signs of Lyme disease between about, let's say, 3 days and 30 days after a tick bite generally include fevers, headache, chills, fatigue, muscle and joint aches, and swollen lymph nodes. That rash I spoke about earlier, the erythema migrans, it's called migrans because it could migrate. A person can have multiple bullseye rashes. I've seen this mostly in adolescents. They tend to get multiple bullseyes, but I've seen it in adults as well. And that occurs roughly 40%, although some statistics say as high as 70 or 80% of infected persons. I don't tend to see it that high. And the erythema migrans begins at the site of a tick bite, usually at around day 3, or it could occur any time between day 3 and 30, roughly after the first week or 7 days or so. The lesion, the erythema migrans, will expand over a period of multiple days up to about even as many as 12 inches across, or 30 centimeters. It usually feels warm to the touch. It's not usually itchy. It's not usually painful. Sometimes as it enlarges, it clears a bit. It's less red, erythema. It's less red. And that clearer area in the center gives us a target, or what's called a bullseye appearance. And remember what I said earlier, that newer thinking is that any red lesion, a mark on the skin that's 2 inches or more, might be Lyme disease, even though it doesn't look anything like erythema migrans. Or a person could have no skin manifestations whatsoever. The rash can occur anywhere on the body. Now, in terms of traditional treatment, and this could get a bit complicated, but I'm going to give you the basics. When people are treated with the appropriate antibiotics in the early stages of Lyme disease, they generally recover very rapidly, and they recover completely. This is shocking to some of you, because when I've talked to you, you'll say something like, Dr. Wald, I'm told that, or I'm under the impression that most Lyme disease is not curable. That's actually not true. Most Lyme disease does seem to be curable, to the point where when people get their doxycycline, for example, or if they're an adolescent, it might be amoxicillin, or if you have an allergy to doxycycline, it might be amoxicillin or some other antibiotic, they're good to go. They have no issues. But there are always outliers there. And those people may have the typical symptoms of Lyme disease that they just carry on and on and on, or they might extend to other neurologic symptoms or cardiac issues. And those, when those symptoms come up, hard neurologic signs and cardiac signs, those forms of Lyme disease illness generally require intravenous treatment with the IV forms of antibiotic, like penicillin, to give you one example. And if you wanted to, you can go to the Center of Disease Control's website, and you can see by year and with the map illustrations where Lyme disease tends to aggregate. I won't spend any time on that today. But what I will say is that Lyme disease is known to be the most commonly reported vector-borne illness in the United States. And in 2005, it was considered the sixth most common nationally nationally noted or notifiable disease, which means that doctors are reporting it to the Center of Disease Control, and that's how statistics are formed. And it seems from all the information gathering of infection rates and where these people are that it does not occur nationwide. It's generally concentrated most heavily in the Northeast and upper Midwest portions of the United States. So places like Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, all the M's, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Jersey, of course, New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Wisconsin. Let's actually speak about precautions for protection of ticks. Now, it's of course a very good idea to take preventative measures against ticks year-round, but one needs to be very, very vigilant in the warmer months, you know, between April and September, because ticks are much more active then. So first thing you want to do is, of course, avoiding direct contact with ticks as much as possible. So wooded areas, brushy areas with high grass and leaf litter, these are sieves for ticks. When you're walking on trails, for example, when the weather permits, walk in the center of the trail. There tends to be fewer ticks there than, of course, on the off the trails themselves. And then there is the tick so-called repellent or repellents, either DEET or permethrin. I think a brief description of what permethrin is important. First of all, it's an insecticide. It's in the family of these chemicals that are found in the chrysanthemum flower, but the permethrin is synthetic, so it is not natural. And it's used in a couple of different ways to control insects. It's used also to control mosquito control population. It's used in food and feed crops, ornamental lawns, on livestock and even pets, in the structure of buildings, even on clothing. It's often also used in places where food is handled. And it was first registered in the U.S. By the United States Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, in 1979. And it was re-registered in 2006, for those of you who are interested. Now, how does this stuff work? Well, permethrin affects insects if they eat it or they touch it. And what it does is it tends to cause degenerative changes in their nervous systems of the insects, causing muscle spasms, paralysis, and of course, killing the insects. Not every time, but survival of the fittest will always have some of these insects survive. It's more toxic to insects than it is to people and to dogs. And that's because insects can't break it down as quickly as people or dogs can. And cats are much more sensitive to permethrin than dogs or people for that matter, because it takes a lot longer for cats, their bodies, their digestive systems to break it down. A question that I'm commonly asked is, can permethrin contribute to the development of cancer? And what I can tell you there is that it has been classified by the IARC, what's known as the International Agency for Research on Cancer, as, quote, not classifiable, as its carcinogenicity or its cancer-causing potential to humans could not be established. That was in 1991. So basically, the IARC could not decide whether or not permethrin could cause cancer. And the U.S. EPA decided that this chemical was likely to be carcinogenic to humans if it was eaten. And this conclusion was drawn just based on just the chemical structure of permethrin, which seems to be a potentially carcinogenic, and also what happens to it in the body, laboratory tests that cause tumors in mice, and evidence of tumors in rats. There's, of course, much more I could say about that particular chemical, but I think we can get the point here that it's not without dangers itself, potentially. Now, let's speak a little bit about DEET. Otherwise known as NN, this is the chemical structure, NN, diethyl M-toluamide. Now, in terms of tick treatments, parents are told that they should apply the product to their children, avoiding their hands, their eyes, and their mouths. Now, this stuff is a very popular insect repellent, and based on some estimates, about 30% of Americans use it every single year. Now, I did a survey of the scientific literature, and from what I can tell, since about 1957, since DEET first appeared on store shelves, there have been about 14 cases of kids who suffered from encephalopathy, which is inflammation of the brain, which produced seizures after DEET or DEET was placed on their skin. Now, one of the kids was under 8, 3 of the children died, the others recovered fully, and in each case it was said that it was just difficult to determine whether or not the DEET was actually the cause of the deaths and the brain symptoms. But that's enough for me personally not to want to go near the stuff. Now, the U.S. Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry has a page of reports in the U.S. of health problems in people using DEET. And now, among those cases, there were 2 deaths in adults, 3 cases in which pregnant women who used supposedly large amounts of this chemical gave birth to babies with some problems. One baby actually died. And with the kids with encephalopathy, in nearly all of the reported cases, it was not determined, or no one at least admitted, that the DEET was the culprit. So as with so much in natural medicine and regular allopathic medicine, allopathic circles would use permethrin and also DEET, and those of us interested in maintaining our brains, nervous systems, avoiding toxicity, cancers, and other problems would probably avoid them. Now, I should say at this point that the information I'm presenting, this is a disclaimer now, because I cannot tell you to not take something that is generally recommended. I would just say, do your own due diligence and decide for yourself. So this information that I'm presenting during this show and all other shows is for education only. And it is not meant to serve as a replacement for sound medical advice. Now, continuing the conversation of preventative strategies, let's talk about finding and removing ticks from your body. So you want to bathe or shower as soon as possible after coming in from outdoors, certainly preferably within the first 2 hours, and wash off right away. And this way, it'll be easier to more easily find ticks that are crawling on you. You want to conduct a full body tick check using a handheld or full-length mirror view all the parts of the body. And you want to check yourself, you want to check your kids for ticks under the arms, around the ears, inside the belly button, behind the knees, between the legs, around the waist, and on the scalp, because these buggers hide in the hair. You want to examine your pets. Ticks are known to ride into the home on pets and also on clothing, such as coats and day packs. In terms of handling the clothes, tumble drying clothes in a dryer on high for 10 minutes might actually kill some ticks. But if the clothes are damp, they're gonna need more time, obviously being dried. And the clothes will likely require washing first, so of course you want it on hot water. You know, cold and medium temperature water will not kill ticks effectively. So if the clothes cannot be washed in hot water, tumble dry them on low heat for 90 minutes or high heat for about 60 minutes. And the clothes must be warm and absolutely completely dry. We don't have time during this show to talk about techniques for taking ticks off pets and the different chemicals that are used on pets and their pros and cons, so you'll need to look into that part yourselves. I'm asked quite a lot about the availability of Lyme disease vaccine, so they're no longer available. There was a vaccine manufacturer that produced a vaccine, and that was discontinued in 2002, I believe. And they cited insufficient customer demand. People just didn't want it. And whatever protection did seem to be afforded by this vaccine clearly diminished over time. So for people who got that vaccine in 2002, the general consensus is they're no longer protected against Lyme disease. Now, another question I'm asked is, you know, how long does the tick have to be attached to the body? And in most cases in the literature, the medical literature says that the tick must be attached to the body for between 36 and 48 hours or before the Lyme disease bacterium can be transmitted. But newer evidence shows far shorter times. So there isn't any particular consensus there. But if you find a tick on yourself, that's kind of good news if you have to get bitten by a tick. If you have the tick, put it in a Ziploc bag, bring it into your doctor, and that tick can be sent to most commercial labs and checked if it contains Lyme disease or other co-infections. So then you'll know whether or not you should be treated or not, or given your philosophy, whether or not you want to avail yourselves of natural therapies. Now, humans are generally infected through the bites of what they'll call the immature ticks. Those are the nymphs, and they're tiny. They're less than 2 millimeters. Super, super difficult to see. They feed during the spring and the summer months, and they transmit the Lyme disease bacteria. But they are much larger and more likely to be discovered and removed if they've had time to transmit
the
bacteria.
Another question that I get is, Dr. Waldo, are there any other ways other than getting bit by a tick that could transmit Lyme disease? And I can tell you that there's no real evidence at all that Lyme disease is transmitted from person to person. So in other words, it's just not going to happen that one person is going to, you know, someone's going to kiss you or touch you or sex. None of that will transmit Lyme disease. Now, Lyme disease can definitely be acquired through pregnancy. Pregnancy may lead to infection of the placenta. It could result in stillbirths. But luckily, research has shown that if the mother is given proper treatment, there's no negative effects on the fetus. So that's good to know. There's also no reports that Lyme disease is transmitted through breast milk. Now, what about Lyme disease transmission and blood transfusion? So scientists have known for several years now that Lyme disease bacteria and also other types of co-infections can and do live in the blood that's stored for donations. So individuals treated for Lyme disease with antibiotics should certainly not donate blood. And the problem, of course, with that recommendation is oftentimes a person will have no idea that they might have an infection because, remember, before someone has symptoms, they do not have symptoms. And if they donate blood at that point, my guess is that there's a tainted blood supply, not just with Lyme disease and co-infections, but with other potentially transmittable diseases of other types. Now, we certainly know that both dogs and cats can get Lyme disease, but no one's shown yet that any evidence that Lyme disease or these animals can spread Lyme disease to their owners. What our pets certainly do is they bring in infected ticks into our home, yard, and other areas of the house. You certainly will not get Lyme disease from eating squirrel meat or venison. But just for safety, I would suggest always adhere to generally good food safety principles. Cooking, if you're a meat eater, cook that meat thoroughly. I have been unable to find any credible evidence that Lyme disease is transmitted through water, food, air, or from bites of either fleas or flies or lice and mosquitoes. Although it has been suggested that Lyme disease and other diseases might be transmittable through mosquitoes. But once again, there's no evidence for that currently. So why don't we talk about the proper technique for removing a tick. Make sure that you use very fine tip tweezers to grasp the tick as close to the skin surface as possible. Pull upward with a steady, even pressure. Don't twist it. Don't jerk the tick. That can cause the mouth parts to break off, remain in the skin. But again, information tends to show that once that tick injects that venom into you, even if you remove the tick completely, it's too much, too little, and too late. And once you've removed a tick from your skin, make sure to thoroughly clean the bit area with some rubbing alcohol, maybe an iodine scrub, or at least soap and water. If you have a live tick, submerge it in alcohol, put it in a sealed container, wrap it tightly in tape, and throw it in the garbage. Don't ever, ever crush it with your fingers. I have had people do that. I've also had some individuals come into the office with seriously embedded ticks, and I asked them why they didn't attempt to remove them, and the answers I got, the responses were, well, I've already had Lyme disease. I can't get it again, right? Yes, you can. You can get Lyme disease over and over and over again. Now, let's talk about something that is the real issue. We're talking about individuals who have very probable Lyme disease at some point in their past, and they were treated once or twice, but they still have persistent symptoms. The symptoms may be identical to what they were before they were being treated with antibiotic therapies, or they might be slightly different, but they're generally exaggerations or about the same as the other symptoms before. And that's called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. Now, it's absolutely very commonplace, and even expected, I would say, that someone who's been treated for Lyme disease, generally with a 2 to 4 week course of antibiotics, they will experience lingering symptoms like the muscle aches and the joint discomforts, pain and fatigue for quite a long time, a few weeks, but commonly a good 6 months in a growing number of cases. I see many people that were treated months ago and still have issues, and they are under the impression that they might still have the infection. Now, they may, because some of you are thinking, well, you know, Lyme disease can bore its way into the nervous system, et cetera, et cetera. That's all very true. But a lot of the time, it is not that. The tick has been killed off, but the person remains with what is thought to be inflammation and the aftermath, for lack of a better term, of what Lyme disease, you know, did to the person's immune system. So it's very similar to what happens in autoimmune responses. Other infections like Campylobacter causes something called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Even when you kill the Campylobacter with antibiotics, the person has serious degenerative problems and could die. Chlamydia, the same thing. You can kill the bug, but if it's done a specific damage to the nervous system, person could develop a very serious autoimmune condition known as Reiter syndrome. Even strep throat. You can often kill strep throat, but if that streptococcus bug has made its way into the cardiovascular system and into the heart, it can damage valves, and that's called rheumatic heart disease. So, you know, in summary, in terms of this very important point, some healthcare providers will tell you that these persistent symptoms are a reflection of persistent infection with Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme disease bacterium, but it may not be. So the people that I have with the post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which is abbreviated PTLDS, they when you follow these people over a long period of time, they do not seem to do any better than placebo. At least that's what the studies say. What I've observed is that many people only have relief when they are taking the antibiotics, and when they're not taking them, they feel worse. And I mentioned earlier in the show that that could be due to the anti-inflammatory effects of the antibiotics, not that the antibiotics are actually killing any more bugs. Now, there are manufacturers of different Lyme disease natural products who will claim that it is all about the bug, and that doesn't surprise me considering they're producing the actual products for the treatment of these of this elusive Lyme disease. I don't think that these products, I've looked at many of them, could actually hurt anyone, but if they're not working for you, you should be thinking not only, oh, maybe I'm not taking enough, or maybe these aren't the wrong remedies. Those are reasonable concerns, but you might not actually have Lyme disease anymore. Again, you is very likely that you are suffering, at least in part, if not fully, from the degenerative stress that the infection, Lyme disease, caused. You know, a simple analogy is thinking of Lyme disease as a fire in a building, and you can use water, of course, to put out the fire, just like you can use antibiotics to put out Lyme disease. Just bear with me for a minute. Those of you saying, well, doxy doesn't kill all Lyme disease, I would beg to differ. It does kill some Lyme disease, and I also would agree with those out there that are under the impression that a different multitude of antibiotics may be needed to manage the different biologic forms of Lyme disease, some that have invaded the nervous system, and there are antibiotics that are needed to pass through the blood-brain barrier, and others that may not be for other tissues. I get all that. That possibility absolutely exists, in my opinion, but I am under the impression that...
Let me clarify this point in a different way. You know, once Lyme disease or any infection is, let's say, favorably managed, killed off with the appropriate antimicrobial therapy, oftentimes these infectious agents will damage tissues all over the place. So the only way that recovery takes place is if the reparative process exceeds the degenerative process induced by the infection. In this case, we're speaking about Lyme disease. So what I do within the context of my blood detective approach is I assess many of the major organ systems of the body. I'll look at nervous system antibodies. I'll check methylation capability, which is a process of healing, and many people have issues with methylation. I'll look at hormones, absorptive tests or malabsorptive tests, beyond just gluten, by the way. There's many, many different types of malabsorption, and also nutrient levels and tests of nutritional or nutrient use. I find that when I do this, I can provide a far more personalized nutritional protocol for a person in terms of foods and definitely nutritional supplements, because with the kind of damage that PTLDS does, nutrition has got to be, must be optimized. There's just no two ways about it. Some liquid tincture remedy, one thing here or there, I promise you that is not going to do it. A comprehensive, well thought out, personalized approach is what is needed to maximize recovery for those who are suffering from, for weeks and particularly months and even years of leftover degenerative stress caused by Lyme disease. So when people ask me, what are the nutrients to take? I never, ever recommend these cliche remedies you'll see all over the web, because they don't work. If they work, it's an absolute miracle. And I do have people who have claimed to me that some of these remedies are working. But when I investigate their labs, or I really speak with them, it's very apparent that it hasn't. So having said that, a combination, I believe, of traditional antimicrobial therapy for Lyme disease is necessary, and the potential issues with that therapy too can be largely offset or at least minimized with the appropriate nutrition. So to give you one example, and we'll talk about a few more in a minute. The individual who finds that they are much better off with repetitive use of antibiotics needs to realize that they're going to need a whole lot more than a potent probiotic to counteract that. Generally, I would use several different varieties of pharmaceutical grade probiotic, of course. That is fundamental. But in addition, I would recommend immunoglobulins, oral immunoglobulins, which act as sort of a molecular glue to help the probiotics stay in the intestinal tract, influencing recovery of the nervous system, of the immune system. 70 or so percent of the immune system is located in the small intestine. But if someone has symptoms in their nervous system or hormonal symptoms that were triggered by infection. Again, infections can be the mimickers of many, many different diseases and health problems. Then it's essential, if you understand this, that nutrition has to be applied to all of the major tissues that are involved. I'll commonly see antibodies develop against what's known as gangliosides, which are components of what's known as the peripheral nervous system, in those that have had Lyme and or are suffering from PTLDS. And successful management of that individual would have to be associated with a reduction of the antibodies. And that is not affected by a probiotic, for example. So I think you're getting the idea that you manage the individual and how they're uniquely affected with Lyme disease or post-Lyme disease, whatever you want to call it, and not merely this cliche approach, take a probiotic. Okay? In my experience, which I admit is not the end-all, other individuals have different experience, but what I have seen is that many of my patients that are suffering from PTLDS have been to a number of traditional docs who have then just diagnosed them also with fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome, and then would give the medications like antidepressants that they might for these conditions, which I think undermines the seriousness of this problem and is really demeaning, I think, to a suffering person. Now, that's not to say that there's never a time to use medications that are typically used in fibromyalgia for PTLDS individuals, but not at the exclusion of the reparative nutritional elements. The individuals that I tend to see are absolutely overwhelmed by their ongoing symptoms. They are frustrated because many of the doctors they've seen are not taking them seriously. And it is extremely important to find a doctor who's willing to make sure that Lyme disease is not the only thing affecting your health, for one, or is to more definitively determine, if it wasn't figured out before, that it is Lyme disease. And it's up to you as the affected individual to become very well informed. But I will admit there is a lot of misinformation out there on the web, so you must find someone that you can trust. Review anything that you've come up with during your research and your self-education to eliminate what is unreasonable, and then to investigate what you found and the thoughts of your practitioner as to the next important steps. But a very simple and very fundamental thing that I recommend is that I have my patients track their symptoms. It's important to keep a diary of your symptoms, your sleep patterns, your diet, your exercise, the supplements you're taking, how much, when you're taking them, how you're feeling on a certain scale that I define for those I work with. Because just like a food log, a symptom log and lifestyle log, really, can reveal many things that are not obvious when you do not keep a log. It would not be unusual for me to examine the lifestyle log of one of my patients to find out other triggers and other sorts of symptoms and onset of certain symptoms that suggest other health problems that I've then looked for and have found. Others that I've seen have said, well, you know, my doctor said that I should, you know, maintain a healthy diet and get plenty of rest. And I say, oh, okay, that sounds perfectly fine. What did he or she define as a healthy diet? And then they look at me because they have no concept. Now, those of you listening to this show obviously do have a concept of optimal diet, but that but your food intake may need to be different if you are, in fact, affected by Lyme disease or post-Lyme disease, you know, treatment syndromes and or other health problems. So, of course, the basics always apply, removing refined and processed carbohydrates and keeping the meat products and highly acidic products extremely low, if not eliminated entirely from the diet, to maintain a high intake of fruits and vegetables. Everything should be organic as much as possible and or free range in terms of the meat and farm raised whenever humanly possible. The last thing you want to be doing is loading yourself up with further toxins that might promote inflammation and trigger further symptoms. But I go a bit further, personalizing the diet based on the chemistry and very detailed questionnaires. I also use body composition, which lets me know caloric needs and metabolic rate. Because, for example, let's say that you need high doses of DHA oil, not DHEA, which is adrenal hormone, and not EPA DHA, which is the more popular fish oil combination you've heard about. But with Lyme disease or the sequelae of Lyme disease, what may follow after the bug is killed or persistent infections, in any scenario, I believe that intake of DHA is essential and needs to be high enough to make it some sort of a difference. So DHA is the most important of the fatty acids, the omega-3 constituents for the nervous system, very potent anti-inflammatory, and it's not enough to just take a few capsules. A person needs an amount that is appropriate for their basal metabolic rate and their lean body mass. These are the sorts of tests that make all of the difference, particularly between someone who takes the right things or takes the right things completely wrong. And if you're wondering if that's you, you just need to ask yourself, how are you doing? If it's been several months since treatment and you're still not well, something may be wrong. I should digress for a quick moment and mention, because I didn't mention this earlier when I was talking about the immunoglobulin testing for a Lyme disease, is that among the different bands that we spoke about that traditional labs use, and then the offshoot labs, like the one in New Jersey I mentioned, there is the PCR or polymerase chain reaction test. And there's some misinformation out there that if that test is positive in an individual, that they have active Lyme disease. That is absolutely untrue. All that that test means is the following. The PCR assays, which, by the way, are done by all traditional labs that are generally covered by your health insurance, they'll detect DNA, which is your genetic material, from either living or dead organisms that you've been exposed to. They don't demonstrate the presence of definitive. Let me say that again. The PCR test measures or detects DNA. That DNA can be from living organisms. It could be from dead organisms. But it's very, very prone to false positive results. So that is not a particularly reliable test either. Now, if someone is really concerned that they have Lyme disease and they're not sure what to make of the testing, we have all this controversy about what test means this or that. Well, if they're willing to find a doctor who's willing to give them a course of antibiotics, well, then that'll do it. If they would rather not take antibiotics, but they still feel they have Lyme disease and they're willing to do natural therapies, then you do that and see how you're doing. But I have seen a large number of people get very carried away with the testing for Lyme disease and without giving any serious consideration. It's not just their fault. It's really the practitioner they've seen as well to checking for other causes of their symptoms. Another question that I get, I had a husband and wife, and they both had Lyme disease, but neither one of them remembered having a tick bite. People will say that to me often. They don't remember, you know, having a tick bite. But first of all, it's not uncommon for more than a single individual in a household to develop Lyme disease simply because the household can be infected with ticks. Ticks love it indoors where it's nice and warm. And the ticks are very, very, very small. So depending on the age of the person, the sensitivity of their skin, the nervous system, they may not feel a bite. And that is usually the case. I should also mention that I'm concerned about, and even I mentioned this earlier in the show, about being the most mentally aware of the possibility of contracting Lyme disease in the warmer months. But a person could be bitten by a tick at that time, but not develop symptoms that they either at all or that they recognize as Lyme disease for even months later. So when a person is, a person during the wintertime says, yeah, I'm having these symptoms, it's winter, so my doctor said it couldn't possibly be Lyme disease. There are many individuals I have found that have Lyme disease in those scenarios. So yes, we should check for that. We also want to check for babesiosis, Ehrlichia, there's several viruses. Depending on the particular symptoms that the individual is manifesting, different types of infectious agents might be checked. Or I like to check antibodies against a variety of body tissues, which gives me some idea about other conditions or the extent that Lyme disease or other tick-borne infections may affect an individual, along with those other tests that I mentioned earlier. The nutritional treatments, which I believe must always be used either after antibiotic therapy has been recommended, or certainly at the same time would be ideal. If, again, using probiotics as a single example, okay, this is just an example. When one is on antibiotics, obviously they're going to have resistance, some amount of resistance to the antibiotic. Not all of the infection is going to be killed. There's going to be some adaptation to the antibiotic and some resistance, and those resistant organisms display what is commonly known as survival of the fittest, and they will perpetuate and grow over the period of time, and then the person could have sort of a recurrence of Lyme disease. If one were to take a probiotic during the time you're taking your antibiotic, that is wrong. You will diminish the effects of your antibiotic potentially if you take them at the same time or too close to your probiotic. Probiotics, I believe, should be taken an hour or more either before or after your antibiotic dose. They should be taken with an immunoglobulin and the probiotic, that is. And probiotics will double their effectiveness, according to some studies, when they're taken with a protein. That little bit of clinical, what we call a clinical pearl, a very important concept, can make all the difference in an individual. Now, will a probiotic make all the difference if you take it with protein for Lyme disease, if you do not take an antibiotic? Nope, that won't work. I've had individuals, particularly some naturalists that I've worked with. I'm thinking of one particular gentleman in the past who believed that he was going to manage his Lyme disease symptoms with just juice fasts and that sort of thing. I can go into the details, but they don't matter. And he was in pretty bad shape. And then after a few weeks, he was a lot better. And he attributed that to his naturalist lifestyle and his juice fasting. Except it's not uncommon for Lyme disease and other conditions to go into a sort of remission where a person does not have symptoms for a period of time. Could be a very long time. And this individual became extremely sick with some permanent neurologic issues because he delayed his treatment. So I would just caution anyone out there to forego antibiotics. What I'm saying is you wouldn't want to do that unless you were just allergic to every type that's available, which is not very common whatsoever. And combine their antibiotic therapy under the guidance of an experienced healthcare provider to minimize the effects of the antibiotics, such as antibiotic resistance, and to maximize your chance of recovery. So, in short, the test for Lyme disease should not just be about infections. They should be looking at a variety of other systems in the body to see exactly why and how this person is displaying these symptoms. And often we will uncover, if not other causes of what we thought were Lyme disease, but we'll find out how more appropriately to help that person recover with natural therapies. The final practical thought I'd like to leave you with today is that it's very important, and I really don't understand why other doctors aren't doing this. I've even seen infectious disease doctors, immunologists fail to do this. When evaluating a patient, we'd want to check all aspects of the immune systems. I've mentioned this in my show, All About Immunity, which you can find on my blog on the website at www.integratednutritionny.com. And by the way, for those who want to reach me personally to work with me, my number is 914-242-8844. But we want to evaluate the cell-mediated immune system. We want to evaluate the neutrophils and the lymphocytes, what are called the subsets of the lymphocytes. We want to look at the complement immune system and the immunoglobulin or antibody immune system. When we see all these systems, we can get a much clearer picture of how precisely the person's immune systems are being affected. So both traditional therapies and natural therapies can be targeted in a much more individualized way. I want to thank everyone for listening to today's show. My name is Dr. Michael Wall, the Blood Detective. Once again, you can reach me at 914-242-8844. Please join me for our next show entitled The Most Important nutritional supplements for your health and well-being, period. Once you listen to this show, your whatever nutritional protocols you've been working on will be much better than they ever have been. See you soon.
Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You got the liquor, start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed you.